This week on Your Western Context, a new group in the Senate sparks calls for reform. China resumes Canadian meat imports to curb inflation, and Alberta starts to enact tougher Castle Doctrine laws. Also, testing has revealed lead in Canada's drinking water while our government is on vacation. This is Western Context, episode 143, recorded Friday, November 8th, 2019, A Poison Cocktail. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are back again this week to discuss the news and then some rather interesting stories that managed to crop up this week.
Yeah, that's right. We had quite a bit of news in this past week that definitely bear a lot of talking about, and certainly a lot of interesting conclusions that were talked about in the media that I think a lot of these stories flew under the radar and didn't really get as much coverage as they should have.
Indeed. And, you know, we've been doing this since January of 2017, this podcast, and what our objective has been for the entire time period has been to provide all the information and context necessary to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news while removing all the media bias and sensationalism that comes along with the news stories. And, you know, we're going to start with our Canada story this week. And this is one that really did fly under the radar. It did draw some attention, but I don't think that the news media nor Canadians have grasped the full gravity of what this story potentially means, because this week the media was largely entertained with the idea that at the midweek caucus meeting, the first meeting of the enlarged Conservative Party since the election, that many in the media thought we'd see a coup against Andrew Scheer, but nothing like that, of course, happened, and it proved to be just the media raising up a story that didn't really pan out and drove the attention away from things that drew or should have drew much more attention. And one of these is our story here about the Senate. So you guys, of course, probably know that we recently elected the House of Commons, the lower house, but what exactly is the Senate? It's sometimes called the upper house or the House of Sober Second Thought, and many times in the past, especially with majority governments, it just acts like a rubber stamp for the government to get their legislation through. But in the rare occasion, the Senate does suggest amendments for bills, and we saw one of those this past spring with Bill C-69, the bill that rejiggered the National Energy Board to modify the way pipeline projects and energy projects are approved in Canada. The Senate suggested many amendments to that bill. They sent it back to the House of Commons. The Liberals rejected those amendments and pushed the bill through anyway, since time was running out before Parliament would be dissolved before the election. And this raises the question, exactly who are the senators making these decisions and who appoints them? Well, senators come all from across the country, and in general, the senators are appointed by the Governor General of Canada. But as this country is mainly run on convention says that the Governor General will appoint senators on the advice of the current sitting Prime Minister. And this is something that has happened for decades prior to Justin Trudeau, except Trudeau has modified the process so that he claims that the process that the Liberals brought in is indeed less partisan. What he's done is he's effectively created a application form where people who might be interested in becoming senators can apply. And then the government looks at this list, and whenever a senator is needed from, say, the West, he picks one and appoints that person. One of the recent appointees of Justin Trudeau was, of course, Edmonton Journal journalist Paula Simons, and she had an interesting time in the Senate this spring voting for C-69 and the like in terms of balancing the, I guess we could say, the lever between whether she should be standing up for what Alberta says or to the government that appointed her. Now, prior to forming government, Trudeau made all the senators that, who were Liberals in the upper chambers sit as independents. This was due to an increasing lens on the Senate in light of the expense scandals that arose and the much-hyped Mike Duffy trial, which found him to be not guilty at the end. previously, the Senate used to mirror the governing parties in that there were liberals and conservatives in the Senate, but that has changed recently. Since Trudeau's plan has ultimately muddied the waters by adding independents into the mix, we've seen new groups form in the Senate that aren't necessarily liberals or conservatives. The Independent Senators Group was formed a couple years after Trudeau dissolved the Liberal caucus in the Senate, and this group makes up the current largest body in the Senate, consisting mostly of the senators appointed by Justin Trudeau and ejected former conservative senators Mike Duffy and Patrick Brazeau. Now, on Monday this week, we got news that there was going to be a new group forming in the Senate, specifically called the Canadian Senators Group. The group issued a press release saying that their intent was for the group to fulfill the original goal of the Senate by being able to represent all the different regions across the country. Having a look at this press release, it says that members of the CSG want to see this founding principle maintained and respected so that the will of the majority does not always trump regional interests. United in their approach to thorough research and comprehensive review of legislation, close consultation with Canadians, and rigorous, at times, but respectful debate, CSG senators are free to take positions and vote on legislation independently of personal political affiliations and each other. Now, this group, as it stands right now, consists of 11 senators. 5 represent the West, 3 represent the Atlantic provinces, 2 represent Ontario, and 1 represents Quebec. 3 of the Western senators represent Alberta, 1 represents BC, and 1 represents Saskatchewan. The group ultimately hopes to be able to focus on direct issues such as energy and the opioid crisis, and they also feel that they'll be more effective in supporting or opposing the legislation that the government sends to the Senate if each senator has the ability to vote based on what represents the interests that are best for that region. Now, with this, no more than after the recent election in recent years have we seen that the regions across Canada have felt more divided. The Senate's original goal was to provide sober second thought on legislation passed by the House of Commons, and this is the way that it currently works in Great Britain. Other Commonwealth countries such as New Zealand abolished their upper house entirely. But recall that back in the 1980s and 1990s, there was a push to reform the upper chamber to be elected, effective, and equally representative of Canada. And this is the thing that still lacks in the Senate today, because right now, Ontario and Quebec each have 24 senators. The other two founders of Confederation, Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, get 10 each, while PEI gets 4. BC, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba each get 6, and the territories get 1 each. A tiny province like PEI gets similar representation in the Senate to that of Alberta, and the entire West only gets as much representation as Ontario or Quebec. The seat of the power in the Senate is clear based on this numeration in that it's still firmly entrenched in the 48 block of Ontario and Quebec. It has been determined by the courts that serious reform or abolishment of the Senate in Canada would require a constitutional amendment getting many of the provinces on board and the population. We also need to remember that Quebec never signed on to the 1982 Constitution, and no Prime Minister has had the will to try and get Quebec on board to sign into the Constitution or make meaningful reforms to the Senate. At this point, the Senate can either become more chaotic with further dissolution of order in terms of splitting apart the parties, or the Senate can become more effective in representing the regions of an increasingly divided Canada. We can only hope here that the new Canadian Senators Group that has been formed will lead to the latter, and at some point, the Senate will see meaningful reforms here in Canada. In a final note on this story, recall that senators appointed by Justin Trudeau and put into the Independent Senators Group were ultimately vetted by a database called the Liberal List, which is nothing more than a partisan database of Liberal contributors. Despite saying that Trudeau would appoint independent senators, most of the senators that he's put into the Independent Senate Group have voted with one mind and one block to support his legislation. It would appear that the definition of independent is in question for Justin Trudeau.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this is something that people saw as soon as he dissolved the Liberal caucus in the Senate, and actually found out as time went on that the independent senators that Trudeau was appointing were actually voting more in line with the government than the former Liberal senators were, and that they were even more of a rubber stamp than what was before. And under the name of Independent Senators Group, they were really just being Liberals anyways. And I think that was providing a lot more cynicism for the Senate. But I think a lot of people, it didn't really get much coverage at the time. And the Senate certainly hasn't got much coverage lately either. And we'll have to see if this new senators group will be able to represent the regions better than what has happened in the past, because certainly the Senate does need to change at this point, and it's hard to know what exactly can be done about it, but there's definitely lots of theories out there. But whether a government will have the political capital or the political will or even care about it enough to do anything.
Yeah, and we're going to have another chance to see what Trudeau does with the Senate as we move into January and February of 2020, because there are a slate of resignations that are coming up, because in the Senate, there's mandatory resignations upon a senator hitting age of 75, and that senator has to resign, and then a new senator is brought in. So we'll see if the senators that the prime minister picks in January and February of 2020, and a few more in 2020, do decide to sit with the independent Senate group, or maybe a few will actually sit with the Canadian senators group and vote for their regions instead. And that will be the true test of independence in the Senate for this parliament. And, as we like to say here at Western Context, we operate in chapters, and we'll be definitely watching this one as we move forward. But I think with that being said, we can move on to our next story, which was being talked about as a bit of a victory for Canada, but we might view it a different way. So what do we got for that?
Yeah, that's true. It's been called a victory for Canada, and certainly a victory for Canadian farmers, but how much of a victory it actually is will be remained to see, of course. And that is, of course, the story about China resuming importing beef and pork from Canada. And China has agreed to allow Canadian meat products back into their country, which ended a 5-month suspension. China originally halted the importation of Canadian beef and pork back in June, saying that some Canadian meat had tested positive for ractopamine, which is an additive that is banned in China, and that some of the meat was sent over with forged inspection certificates. Now, when the Canadians, of course, investigated, they didn't find any such additives, and they didn't find any evidence of the forged certificates either. So it was coming down to on our side of the trade war, just another consequence of what was going on at the time with the chilly relations between the two countries. Now, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau tweeted that the news Tuesday afternoon of the importations being allowed to resume, he called it a set of good news for Canadian farmers. Now, China is one of Canada's largest export markets for pork and for beef. More than $500 million worth of Canadian pork and nearly $100 million worth of Canadian beef were sent to China in 2018 alone, which represents the second and fifth largest markets, respectively, for those meats. Now, Trudeau himself and a few other Liberal cabinet ministers, agricultural minister Marie-Claude Bibeau and Minister of International Trade Jim Carr, they were quick to credit to diplomat Dominic Barton, who was appointed Canada's ambassador to China in September, and they were quick to credit him for China's reversal on the ban of meat imports from Canada. Now, it should be noted that prior to Barton's appointment, the position had been vacant for more than half a year, and the two countries haven't been embroiled in a diplomatic dispute for nearly a year, ever since Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou was arrested in Vancouver last December. Now, two Canadians, Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig, were detained in China just a few days later, and at this point, they still remain in custody there, after almost 210 days. Now, former Ambassador John McCallum, who was a longtime Liberal MP, was dismissed in January after making comments that suggested an element of politicization in Canada's decision to arrest Meng Wanzhou, and said that it would be more expedient for Canada and better for Canada if they were to just ignore our laws and extradition laws with the United States and just decide to let her go back to China. Now, rather than a resumption of friendly diplomacy, the resuming of meat imports from Canada is actually being seen as an act of desperation from Beijing. Guy Saint-Jacques, who is a former Canadian ambassador to China, said that China's decision may have less to do with a thaw in relations than with food supply issues. He said, quote, "The leadership in Beijing was faced with most likely a lot of pressure from Chinese consumers, 1.4 billion Chinese consumers that were complaining that the price of pork had increased by about 70 to 100% just over the past 6 months. Now, China produces and consumes about half of the world's pork, but its herds have been devastated by an outbreak of African swine fever. Approximately 1.2 million Chinese pigs have been killed since August 2018 in an attempt to contain the disease. Now, the decline in supply has caused the price of pork in China to nearly double over the past year, even as the country has increased its imports from Europe and Brazil. Now, China has also kept the bans on Canadian canola in place, which is furthering the theory that Beijing only lifted the pork ban to reduce rapid inflation. Now, a Chinese spokesperson also agreed that the ban lifting wasn't a sign of friendlier relations. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Geng Shuang answered a question at a media briefing in Beijing earlier this week, and he was asked whether China's reopening its market to Canadian pork and beef signaled an improvement in strained relations. And he was very quick to reply that the Chinese government says that relations will only improve when Canada releases Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou. And he said, quote, "As for China-Canada relations, the current difficulties were not caused by the Chinese side." And he said, "We urge the new Canadian government to face up to China's solemn position and concerns, release Ms. Meng Wanzhou at once, ensure her safe return to China, and take concrete actions to move our relations back onto the right track." Now, Saint-Jacques also warned that Canada should brace for a more turbulence in its relationship with China. He said, quote, "The federal government also has to make a decision on whether it will allow Huawei to participate in 5G development in Canada. We have been warned that if they are not allowed there, will be further measures taken against Canada. And for that reason, it's important for the federal government to try to get as much support from allies as possible." Now, Susan Rice, who was the National Security Advisor under U.S. President Barack Obama and the former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, has explicitly warned Canada against allowing Huawei to participate in the construction of its 5G infrastructure. She said, quote, "It's hard for me to emphasize adequately without getting into classified terrain about how serious it is. It gives Chinese the ability, if they choose to use it, to access all kinds of information. Civilian intelligence, military, that could be very, very compromising." She even admitted that she disagreed with the Trump presidency on many, many things, but this is one that she did not. And it should be noted that the U.S. government blacklisted Huawei in May, deeming it a national security risk, meaning that U.S. firms aren't allowed to sell the company's technology without government approval. Now, Canada has yet to make its call, but Susan Rice insists that the U.S. decision isn't one that Canada should ignore. Especially tricky is Canada's key position in the Five Eyes intelligence-sharing group that also includes the U.S., the U.K., Australia, and New Zealand. And her suspicion is that should Canada open the doors further to Huawei, it risks being cut out of shared information from the Five Eyes. Now, one thing's for sure, the relationship with China remains as complicated as ever, and it remains difficult to predict what exactly the communist regime will do next, and our government will have to remain vigilant and to continue to do all it can to get our Canadian detainees in China repatriated while maintaining our national security and our rule of law.
When it comes to China, this is something that this government should have learned, being in power for 4 years now at this point, that China works on one principle, and that's what's best for China. And they don't care what the rest of the world has to think. They're going to do what is best for China. And, you know, you see that based on banning beef, banning pork, banning canola. And this all comes from this dispute that the U.S. and Canada worked to extradite and hold Meng Wanzhou, CFO of Huawei, which Huawei is one of China's star companies. And just a bit of background for our listeners is that in China, if you have a business, you serve at the pleasure of the Chinese government, even more so as businesses get larger. If you do something that the Chinese government doesn't like, you risk not being able to operate. If you, in turn, are very thoughtful and very courteous to the Chinese government, you'll have a good time operating your business in China. And this is why you see all the large companies out there, even North American-based ones such as Facebook, such as Google, Apple, all trying to curry favor with the Chinese government. It's because they need to do that in order to operate in those countries. So when we see a company like Huawei that is based in China and is wanting to spread throughout the world, everybody needs to know, the governments know this, the intelligence circles definitely know this, but the governments need to bring this idea forward that when you have a company like Huawei, it is an extension of the Chinese government. And when it comes to intelligence and national security and safety of civilians in the Western world, that's something you don't want to play around with.
Yeah, exactly. Especially given what's going on with Hong Kong, certainly letting Huawei in and giving another access point for Chinese to get more on civilian intelligence and even military intelligence, given that they'd be in our cellular infrastructure. It's quite a dangerous game that the government is playing and not actually having a concrete position on this issue, because it's such a dangerous thing that could happen. And definitely our position in the intelligence community, especially with Five Eyes, means that we could even be cut off from our allies on this issue. And given that our position is in between all of these major superpowers, US to the south, we've got Russia over the North Pole, and we've got China to our west, it's a precarious position that Canada is in, trade-wise, but also intelligence-wise. And the government's going to have to be very careful about how they proceed on this issue. But one thing is for certain, we cannot compromise Canadian law, and we cannot compromise our national security.
Yeah, and, the Canadian public is missing out on this story when the media marks this as a huge win for Canada, Canadian diplomacy, and Canadian farmers. Yeah, that's all well and good, but at the end of the day, it all comes down to what China wants at the end of the day, and that's its Huawei executive back, and for the Huawei technology to be used in the next generation of 5G technology in Canada and in the rest of the world. And that was sorely missed in the media this week, so we're going to definitely be watching this. And I feel like this is something we say with every story here, but that is indeed how it is here at Western Context. We're always watching to see what the media is missing, the things that are just out there that are so clear when you look at everything, the context that you miss, that the media misses. And we, of course, have been doing this since January of 2017. And if you want to help us do that, you can check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/Western Context. And there we offer three tiers of support. So for $2 a month at the price of a cup of coffee, you can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. And for $5 a month or the price of a sandwich, you can continue to help us do that, and you can have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And finally, for $10 a month or the price of a good lunch, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. And, you know, when we reach $25 a month in contributions, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we'll reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide our opinion on where affairs are headed next. And at $50 a month, you can expect online town halls hosted every quarter. Topics of discussion will include the news of the month, the state of the media, and your questions. We also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can do at westerncontext.ca/support. And while you're there, you can read up on the Patreon option as well, once again at westerncontext.ca/support. All right, so we're going to move into our next story right now, and this is one that pivots back to Alberta, and in particular, we're going to be talking about rural crime, because rural crime has been a problem that's been growing in Alberta for a long time, ever since the economic downturn started, and property owners sometimes don't have the time to wait for the RCMP to arrive. The vast land between RCMP outposts means that sometimes people can be waiting for 45 minutes to an hour for the RCMP to arrive, so they need to take actions into their own hands. And for anyone who's been in that situation, there's always the question about what can be done by a property owner under the law and what is ultimately too far. So back in February of 2018, Eddie Maurice saw people going through his car at 5 a.m. He shouted and asked them to leave, and they didn't. When they didn't leave, he fired two warning shots, and one of the shots ricocheted and hit one of the perpetrators, Ryan Watson, in the arm. After this, he called the police, and Watson was ultimately arrested. Watson then sued Maurice for $100,000 plus damages and for disability. And with this is all while Watson was ultimately sentenced to 45 days in jail. The province, the Justice Department of Alberta, was also suing Maurice for damages and the cost of health services in treating Watson, of all things, which is a real head-scratcher when you think of it. And that's exactly what Justice Minister Doug Schweitzer thought. And he put an end to this back in September by ending the lawsuit that the province had going out for Eddie Maurice. The charges against Eddie Maurice had to work their way through six court appearances before the charges were finally dropped, and through this he incurred a substantial legal bill. A GoFundMe was started, and both the Premier and Justice Minister contributed to this, as well as many grassroots people in rural Alberta helped pay for the legal bills. So the question right now is, why are we talking about this? Well, this week, the government announced that they're changing the law so that as long as a person is not convicted of a criminal offense while protecting their property, they won't be able to be sued by the perpetrator. The amendment will go into effect retroactively going back to January 1st of 2018, meaning that the charges that currently apply to Maurice's court ordeal could be dropped if the courts are willing. This then opens the door to a broader discussion on rural crime. The Justice Department wants to come up with a series of guidelines of what constitutes reasonable force, because that's always a gray area. It's a gray area here in Canada, and it's a gray area in many other areas of the world. Communities will also be able to testify how lawbreakers' crimes hurt the community. And also on top of this, and this is a big one, fines will be increased by a factor of 5, with fines up to $10,000 for a first violation and $25,000 for subsequent offenses, as well as prison time for up to 6 months. Corporations that help trespassers either in carrying out a crime or hiding them after the fact would face fines of up to $200,000, and the maximum for lost or damaged property will be raised from $25,000 to $100,000. The province also wants to crack down on metal theft, as it's common to see theft of copper and other heavy metals from industrial batteries all the way to copper used in power transmission systems. A law to deal with this theft of scrapped metal was passed in 2012 by a former government was never proclaimed. The government proclaimed this law into action this week, and it will go into effect immediately. So you might be asking yourself, why is this important aside from the rural crime angle? Well, it all comes down to reasonable force. And for anybody who remembers back in 2012, the former Harper Conservative government federally amended the Criminal Code of Canada to allow for citizens' arrest to take place and to clarify the use of force. In particular, as written in the Criminal Code following this amendment, a person is not guilty of an offense if they believe, on reasonable grounds, that force is being used against them or another person, or that a threat of force is being made against them or another person. B, the act constitutes the offense is committed for the purpose of defending or protecting themselves or the other person from that use of threat of force. Or C, the act is committed in reasonable circumstances. Property can be defended as well if they believe on reasonable grounds that another person is about to enter, is entering, or has entered the property without being entitled by the law to do so, is about to take the property, is doing so, or has just done so, and the final point, is about to damage or destroy the property or make it inoperative, or is doing so as well. And these are all the cases where a person would not be guilty of offense. And you'll note here that it doesn't necessarily clarify what reasonable force is, just that reasonable force may be used. Eddie Maurice fit the definition of the law as set out in 2012. There was just a provision in Alberta that allowed the accused to sue him for damages, and that's going away. What will be interesting to watch from this is the Alberta government's definition of what exactly is reasonable force. In theory, the government could set a high bar for this, enabling most anything to fall under the umbrella of reasonable force. And this would mean that property owners would be able to do whatever they deem necessary to protect themselves and or their property. That's why this definition, when it comes out from the Alberta Justice Department, is going to be so important. And for the critics out there that say this makes way for vigilantism, we're still a long ways away from matching what many states in the United States have that are known as stand your ground laws or castle doctrine that allow a person to defend their property without any risk of facing a charge. Last month in rural Georgia, a neighbor helped out his friend when he heard a commotion and gunfire. He then gunned down three intruders who were in his neighbor's house and is not expected to face charges. And more recently in Florida, a pregnant woman defended her home with her semi-automatic rifle as her husband was being beaten by an intruder. She'll face no charges. Her husband is recovering and the intruder is dead. We'll be watching this, as it's almost guaranteed that the inherent urban media focused around Edmonton and Calgary will be concerned with the changes this week and any potential definitions that the government comes up with in terms of reasonable force.
Yeah, and this is a very big issue for a lot of Albertans, given that a lot of the population, well, admittedly, quite a bit of it is concentrated in Edmonton and Calgary, but there is a very significant amount of people living in more rural parts that are far away from the nearest town, and certainly far away from towns that will have a police detachment. And it can mean that if there's trouble going on in the rural areas, a lot of times the criminals will go out to the rural areas specifically because they know that a police response is further away and that it will be much harder for the people to get help from the police if they show up, and that they can be in and out within half an hour and to get what they need and get out of there before the police would ever arrive. And I think a lot of people were getting very frustrated by this because the police obviously can't do much about it when they're long gone and they only have a eyewitness description of what actually happened. Most times people have things stolen right out of their yard or even out of their homes, and there's nothing that could be done about it. So this law being put in place for here will be a further deterrent for people that will be showing up and have that idea that they could be met with equal force.
Indeed. And, you know, looking at this, this is one of the many things that could be talked about this week in the media, and in particular, I imagine it is being talked about in the local papers throughout the province. Okotoks is around where Eddie Maurice was initially from, but here in the media, here in Edmonton and Calgary, the focus is still on what the government is doing with its budget, what the teachers' unions and the nurses' unions are all having to say regarding the cuts and the path back to balance in that budget, even though when you have stories such as this and many other very interesting things that happened in the Alberta legislature this week that weren't talked about. And this is something that many people wanted to see happen, and this is why there was such a groundswell of support for the United Conservative Party rurally in the last election here in Alberta. But of course, we're going to move on to our firing line segment next, and this one actually deals with the urban centers of the city and something that should worry anybody who drinks water, which is all of us.
Exactly. And usually our firing line segment is used to discuss a story that either received little to no media coverage at all, or it received the wrong kind of coverage, or in a sense it just dealt with something so ridiculous that it just bears talking about. And I don't know if this story happens to have any of those topics, but in this particular case, it is certainly ridiculous that the government is not actually talking about it or even making mention of it at all. And the fact that it came out was a bit of a surprise to a lot of people. And the headline read very ominously, "This is not a joke, high levels of lead found in water at Canadian daycares and schools." And certainly it wasn't just daycares and schools that it was found at, but quite a few other places as well. And a new study that has found that some Canadian cities have higher levels of lead in their drinking water than Flint, Michigan. And yes, that is, of course, the very same Flint, Michigan that has become infamous across America over the past few years, of course, for giving birth to documentary maker Michael Moore, as well as having extremely poor quality drinking water. Now, Flint made headlines globally when residents started raising an uproar over the toxic water that was coming out of their taps after their water source was switched in 2014 to the Flint River. American journalist Anna Clark said that the water was more corrosive and officials were not treating it for all of the corrosion control, something that you can add to the water at the treatment plant to keep metals in the pipes from disintegrating into the drinking water. Now, as Flint's pipes degraded more, the water turned brown, which was a sign of iron breaking down into it. Now, of course, although the iron was repulsive and alarming, she said, in fact, the most dangerous thing in the water was the lead, which was not visible to the human eye. And she said that a lack of transparency and accountability from officials was the main reason that the situation became so critical. She said, quote, "In Flint, when residents were bringing up concerns, they were dismissed. And as they were dismissed, the problem escalated. What changed was that they were able to partner with outside professionals to get more and a better idea that showed what was really going on, because it contradicted what the state of Michigan had been saying." So what does all this have to do with Canada? Well, a year-long investigation, a very huge investigation by many journalists, countless universities, as well as many media groups across the country, conducted tests on hundreds of homes, schools, and daycares in 11 different cities across the country. And the study found that a third of the tests recorded lead levels above Canadian guidelines of 5 parts per billion, and some cities had lead levels that far exceeded those guidelines. Now, up until the mid-1950s, lead was the standard material for service lines and the water, which were the water pipes connecting a home to a street's water main. Now, lead pipes continued to be permitted by the National Plumbing Code of Canada up until 1975, when awareness about the risk of lead grew. Now, by the mid-1990s, the public portion of most lead service lines were converted to copper. But some still remain, and it's hard to know where those are without actually testing and digging up the pipes in general. Now, unfortunately, in Canada, there is no national mandate to test drinking water, and agencies that conduct tests have no obligation to actually inform residents. Provinces set their own rules for water testing and lead pipe replacement. In British Columbia, where Prince Rupert recorded lead levels of 15.6 parts per billion, municipalities were not actually required to test tap water. Now, in Edmonton, utility company EPCOR conducts hundreds of tests in homes without lead service lines, regardless of when the building was constructed. Between 2015 and 2018, the utility says that it found that 10% of homes had lead levels exceeding the recommended federal limit. Now, Edmonton Mayor Don Iveson agreed that action was needed, but defended the city's water systems. He said, quote, "Recognizing that the pipes need to change over time and there's work to do overall, I have full confidence in the water supply and integrity of it in our city." Now, coming back over here to Victoria, the risk of unsafe levels of lead in Greater Victoria drinking water is recorded as very low, according to Island Health, and running the taps first thing in the morning and after work should be enough to flush the higher concentrations that accumulate over several hours. Now, tips given by Island Health include running water after a period of inactivity until it comes out cold before drinking it or using it for cooking. Avoiding using hot water from the tap for drinking or cooking, as the heat is more likely to cause lead to leach into the water, and also replacing any lead piping or old brass faucets and valves with new fixtures, and installing a water filter at the end of the tap will also reduce the risk of lead. Now, prolonged exposure to high amounts of lead over months or years can lead to can result in lead poisoning, which has serious health effects, particularly amongst young children, although lead poisoning also affects people who are pregnant the most, as well as elderly and those with health issues. This new study about Canada's drinking water has frightening implications for the entire population. Men could experience more hypertension, and older women may have a higher risk of Alzheimer's if they contract lead poisoning. And at the end of the day, it's still a neurotoxin, and it can affect us all. Now, crumbling infrastructure in Canada should see a higher investment by the Trudeau Liberals countrywide. However, much of the past 4 years has been either focused on green initiatives or on expensive projects with little benefit. All we've heard out of the Liberals on this issue that's been brewing over the past week is that Health Minister Jeanette Petipas-Taylor has said that the federal government was monitoring the situation and planning to work with the provinces and municipalities. And Liberal backbencher Bob Bratina has proposed a private members' bill that would create a national strategy to deal with lead in drinking water. However, as the crisis gets more coverage and worried Canadians are talking more and more about it, Trudeau himself remains silent. And perhaps he's been too busy on his vacation in Tofino, BC, where he's been surfing and relaxing for the past week. Instead of taking the message that Canadians sent him on October 21st to heart, not 2 weeks later, he was already on another vacation. Now, while Trudeau's cabinet will be reportedly focusing on, quote, the green economy and climate change, he is flying back to Tofino and back again for the weekend. One wonders if he had to take a second plane for his luggage this time as well, like he did on the campaign. Now, people were wondering why there was a whole month in between the election and Trudeau's new cabinet being sworn in. I guess we know why that is, and that he had to have a vacation after a very stressful campaign. Now back to reality. I think we all know that First Nations reserves and rural communities have had to deal with problematic drinking water for years, and now even our largest cities like Montreal, Toronto, Regina, and Edmonton are having problems. Enough is enough. It's time for our government to stop acting like it's on vacation and to get to work on doing the job that Canadians sent them to do.
Yeah, and you know, being from Edmonton, one of the things we saw this week regarding this was an initial response from both EPCOR and the mayor that defended the water quality in the city with this. And, you know, it doesn't take much to see you go around Edmonton. You see, as you mentioned, the crumbling infrastructure, whether it be the roads. And, you know, there's also a lot of areas in the city where sewer lines need to be replaced. And that also moves into EPCOR's territory in terms of the water mains as well. And the cities, Edmonton, Calgary, all the cities in this country get money for various things from their provincial governments, but the money also does come for various projects from the federal government too. And most of the focus in the recent years has indeed been on green transportation systems like the LRT here in Edmonton and in Calgary. Also, in the past, we've seen a focus on new roads, new highways, and new interchanges, but we don't really hear that much all that often about the very core of the matter right below our feet, the water mains, the sewer lines, and the sidewalks and the roads in the cities, which indeed do need some work. And it would be, of course, a good thing for the city governments to focus on them. And rather than asking their favorite provincial governments and their favorite federal government for money for things like the LRT projects, maybe they should ask them next time for money for infrastructure like new pipe.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of people that are talking about this issue, going out and about, hear people talking about it even more. So I think this is something that is worrying Canadians more than it's actually worrying the governments, because the governments are just wanting to say, oh, yes, it's all fine. But that's really because they don't want to actually deal with the issue themselves. And I think just the silence that we've had from the federal government on this issue, Parliament may not be in session yet, but there are still ways of talking to the media and getting your message out. And the fact that we haven't heard anything from Trudeau on this issue, which is a very serious issue, is quite surprising. And the fact that he could comment on the China issue and call it a win, but not actually talk about this issue, I think should worry a lot of Canadians, because it's just showing that he's wanting to talk about things that seem like they're good, when actually he should be talking about things that are needing to be fixed by the federal government and something that he should be planning to do about it. The election is over, and now it's time to get to work.
Yeah, and indeed, anytime you have something that boils down to be a public health issue, that's something that should be talked about. And that's exactly as simple as it is. All right, what do we got for Word of the Week this week?
So our Word of the Week this week is independent, which is defined as free from outside control, not depending on another's authority. And I think quite clearly this could describe the independent senators group, which it says that it's free from outside control and not depending on another's authority, but it really throws into question just how independent the independent senators actually are. And certainly the word independent could be used to describe China in the sense that they're not depending on anyone else and what they're doing is good for China. And the fact that we're dependent on them for our export markets is pretty worrying, especially given the issues that have cropped up with China over the past year and a half or so. And certainly independence could be in place for the Alberta story as well, in which that homeowners and rural property owners now actually have the independence to protect what is theirs. And that's something that a lot of people in the rural areas of Alberta and probably a lot of other rural areas in Canada were hoping to see.
Indeed. And, you know, everything we talked about this week, every one of these stories, save for one of them, had supplemental sources applied to them. And if you want to read up on these, whether it be about the lead or Huawei or Eddie Maurice, you can do that at westerncontext.ca with our full show notes. You can also subscribe to the podcast there on any number of podcast listeners at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Pocket Casts, Google Play, practically anything under the sun, all at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And you can also find us on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where we share the stories that we're looking at throughout the entire week and some other interesting little tidbits here and there. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always make sure to look through all the stories that the media is talking about and some that they aren't talking about, and certainly some that they should be talking about, just to be able to cut through all the bias and sensationalism that we always see in the mainstream media, no matter what the subject does and no matter where the media is found, whether it's radio, TV, print, no matter what it is, we'll always provide you with the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we will see you next week for another episode of Western Context.